The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McInnes. It's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Willie Vallott, and he joins us on the telephone out in Oregon. Welcome to the show, Willie.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Willie, you've got a new book out, and you've got a new album out with your band, The Delines, and I'd like to talk about both. You're hitting both my sweet spots here, books and music, and I'm really excited about talking to you because I absolutely love your new novel. It's called The Horse. And from what I understand, this surprisingly was inspired by some real events that happened. I understand you were like out in the desert and something happened out there.
Yeah, you know, I was driving around with this old friend of mine, and we were, in central Nevada, maybe 30 miles from the nearest paved road, out, went over a ridge and came down to a huge kind of salt flat, a big playa, and they have them out there that are so big, an hour away, they did a land speed record there, so like really large kind of playas, and there's nothing out there, barely even sagebrush, and we saw what looked like the statue, and so we drove over to it and parked, and we realized it was a wild Mustang. And it was completely blind. And it was an old man. It had scars all over its body. And, like we all do as you get older. And it just stopped me in my tracks. I think that just the brutality of it, maybe. And the sadness of a horse being alone and blind. Two horrific things for anybody, but a horse especially, and no water around. So we camped near it that night, and then the next morning we drove back into town to talk to the Bureau of Land Management. They came out for the horse, and we kind of kept moving on with the trip, but, oh, man, that horse kind of stopped me in my tracks, thinking about a bunch of stuff, but one about just getting old, I guess, too, And so we went farther out, and we were at this old mining claim, and I told my buddy, I said, look, I think I'm going to just jump out here. I'd been touring a lot in my band, and my life was kind of going sideways, and I said, I think I'll just get out here. I don't think I can handle humanity, and I don't think I can handle seeing things like a blind horse anymore. And he just kind of doubled over laughing and said, man, where are you going to plug in your record player? You'll be calling your wife. You'll be hitching a ride to find a place to call your wife, begging her to take you back, and she won't take you back because you're crazy. And I went home and, kept living my life and wrote a story. My first one about music and about that horse, I think, and the life of a musician all wrapped into one.
And that brings us to Al. And as your story begins, the horse, Al is living out in the middle of nowhere. He's a musician. He's a songwriter like you. I believe this is a terrain you know very well. Aren't you originally from that area?
I did. I grew up and spent, till I was 26 in Reno. So far away, a few hours away, but I grew up camping in that area, sure.
He's written all these songs, but he's kind of reached the end of it. He's living out there in this place that you imagined you might want to move to get away from it all. And he's not taking very good care of himself. He's got a drinking problem, a lifelong drinking problem, and he's suffered a lot of losses in his life. And I love this technique you use where he'll think of a song that he wrote, and then he'll do a flashback to that part of his life. And I think the first big loss in his life, according to my memory, was his uncle. Is that right?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, like his only kind of real father figure he lost pretty young. And his uncle, both his uncle and his great uncle, both really struggled with alcoholism. And But yeah, that was his, like, his best friend and, you know, probably his best family member that treated him the best was his uncle.
And as we cascade through these losses and the grinding ordeal of playing in all these bands, that a lot of them were playing casinos and they're playing covers, and he keeps trying to leave the life and going and doing what else he knows how to do, which is a cook in diners. He's kind of bouncing back and forth. But by the time we meet him at the beginning, he's feeling pretty defeated and pretty lost. And all those losses have piled up. And it seems like he's near the end of his life. And then a horse shows up. And these two recognize each other, or at least Al recognizes in the horse that they both have all these scars and they're both near the end. And he feels this deep connection with this horse, doesn't he?
Well, I think it's that idea, like, if the only way to save yourself if you're drowning is to save somebody else who's drowning, that idea. And I think it kind of wakes up. He's on a kind of a slow, self-destructive path, as you do when you isolate too much. You know, reality starts drifting away from you a bit, and I think your ability to stay positive drifts away if you isolate too much. And I think that, yeah, seeing the horse, he sees, I think, a lot of himself, but also it kind of wakes him up, and he realizes, like, look, I have to get myself together to help this horse, because it's you know, it breaks his heart, and it also, I think, reminds him of himself. And you're not really even sure if the horse is real in it, and you're not sure if Al's gone mad either. So, yeah, all that kind of mixed in together. It was a tough balance with all the flashbacks and all the songs and all the years as a musician. It took me a long time to figure out that mixture.
Well, it's fun, because he's remembering hundreds of song titles, and we notice a pattern in these. And late in the book, he's got a woman. He's been doing these songs for various different people, and sometimes bands will play his stuff and sometimes they won't. But this woman observes that, well, Al, all your songs are really sad. And I'm guessing maybe this is kind of personal for you, because When you got together your new band, the DeLines, didn't your vocalist kind of make a similar observation about you?
Yeah, man. Well, she took me aside one night. We were playing in Dublin, Ireland, and she took me aside and kind of grabbed me by the arm. Like, I always think of it like your aunt grabbing you by the arm and like to kind of scold you. And she just took me aside and said, you know, look, I'm a normal girl. I need a little romance once in a while. Can the guy and girl just, you know, fall in love and stay in love for once? Does it always have to be tragic with you? And so I went home, and I feel bad because she's so cool. Amy Boone's the singer, and she's so damn cool, and she puts up with my songs. And so I went home, and I just tried as hard as I could to write straight up love songs, and I wrote a handful of them, but the one that made the record and the one that was the best was Mr. Luck and Miss Doom.
And that's the title track. Do you want us to play that one right now? We could.
Yeah, I'd be honored.
Why don't you introduce it? Here's the songwriter Willie Vallotton with his band The DeLines, and this is the title track to the new CD that just came out. Tell us about this song.
Yeah, Mr. Luck and Miss Doom, like I said, was my attempt at a true romance song. It's about a depressive house cleaner and a kind of a bumbling criminal who only did one crime and he got caught and did 4 years. Well, they meet and they fall madly in love, and somehow they work it out. He keeps her from being too depressed, and she makes sure that she holds all the money and makes all the decisions for him. And together, nothing bad ever happens to him again. And so I gave that to Amy, and she liked me again for a bit.
All right. You're listening to Book Nook on WYSO 91.3, introducing you to your new favorite song, and maybe it's this one, Mr. Luck and Ms. Doom by the DeLines, taking us into the break.
Miss Doom was half living in her car, cleaning houses in St. Augustine, Florida. Mr. Lucky just gotten on the bus. He done 4 years. First crime, first bust. That's how his name stuck. Now Miss Doom is getting yelled at by her boss outside a mansion that overlooks the bay and the cross. While Mr. Luck is thinking who he could call just to stay a week till he can get himself back on his feet. Mr. Luck and Miss Doom, they never check out before. They always get out before it falls through. Doom was just walking down the street. They got to talking and they swept each other off their feet. Mr. Lucky and Miss Doom, she never falls off the world because it's him she's holding on to. Their clothes are
Book Nook continues on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I've been joined on the telephone by Willie Vallotton out in Oregon. Willie, we just played a song off the new album by the D-Lines, Mr. Luck and Miss Doom, the title track. And I'm wondering, we have a moment in your new novel, The Horse, where Al, our songwriter who's down on his luck, he hears a song that he wrote on the radio. And I'm wondering, do you remember the first time you ever heard one of your songs on the radio? What was the song? What was the radio station? What time of day or night was it? How did you feel?
You know, God, that's a really good question. I wrote a song, I think it was called Conveyor Belt. And it was, I mean, this is the first one, which I was in Reno. It was on a college radio station. And I think they played that song, and I did. I teared up. You know, I cried a little bit. It's just really exciting and really was really fun. Now, if I heard that song again today, I'd put my head in the sand. It wasn't one of my best, but, you know, I was a kid. And then, you know, occasionally you hear stuff on the radio, and it's really fun. And, you know, like the NPR affiliates will play my old band, Rich and Fontaine, instrumentals on like pickup lines or in between segments. And, oh, man, it always makes you feel so good. And it's just really fun.
You'll hear one of those music beds, and you'll go, that's us.
Yeah, it's great, and you know, and my voice isn't on it. It's just instrumental, and so I can be proud of it. You know, when I hear my own voice, I get a little squeamish, and I always obsess about lyrics. So I'm always like, we'll listen. If I have to listen to my music, I'll be like, oh, maybe I should have changed that and put a but, and maybe I should have cut that line, and you know, it's endless. But with an instrumental, you're just proud.
Well, I think that must have just been an amazing experience when you heard that first song that you wrote, even if you're embarrassed of Conveyor Belt now. You
yeah.
were kind
yeah, it was my, you know, I was always obsessed with working class issues, and that was one of my early attempts at writing a decent working man song.
Sounds like somebody in a factory trying to keep up.
Yeah, it's that kind of idea of like your whole life is, you know, just the same day after day after day after day, and how do you get through? Which I always really struggled with that, because I'd only worked in warehouses and trucking companies up until I was 30, and then I became a house painter, which I liked a lot more. But going to the trucking company every day, man, it was hard on my head. I'm not the best at doing the same thing over and over the exact same way.
Mm. If you're just tuning in, my guest is Willie Vallotton. His new book is The Horse, and he's also got a new album out with the D-Lines, and it's called Mr. Luck and Ms. Doom. And you were kind enough to send me a copy of that CD, as well as a bonus CD. You sent me the companion CD for your novel Lean on Pete. It's called A Motorcycle for a Horse, and there was a warning on it that I had to read your book before I listened to this. But since I didn't have the book, I listened to it anyway. And you do a great job on this. This is like kind of an audiobook thing where you're reading from your book, and I thought it was pretty cool.
Oh, I love doing that. You know, I've done three of them. I did one called The Kill Switch, which the D-Lines did the music for, and then I did another one called A Jockey's Christmas, about, you know, an overweight alcoholic jockey who comes home for the holidays. It's my Christmas kind of story. And, yeah, they're just fun to do. You know, I put music behind them and make it kind of like a, you know, an experience, like a soundtrack almost. And I do the audiobooks for most of my books. I've done it. And I'm always trying to get them to put more music into the audiobooks, but they're pretty strict about what they want.
Well, you got a great voice for it, and I learned yesterday that yesterday was the 100th anniversary of the first commercial usage of microphones, and a guy recorded a song on a microphone, and this really changed our worlds in radio and in music. It's just an amazing thing to think of not having them. And
yeah, that is crazy.
I was so tickled when I realized that it had been 100 years yesterday since we got these wonderful devices to help us entertain people, to help us make recordings and make things that sound good. And I'm talking on one right now.
And
it's just such a cool thing. And speaking of Al again, you're a protagonist in The Horse. We talked about him losing his uncle and what a big loss that was for him. Well, another huge thing, another hole in his heart in this story is the loss of his wife and what happened to her. And this just, it's almost heartbreaking. And I don't want to make it sound like your book is depressing and a bummer, because I actually think it's one of the most uplifting books I've ever read.
Oh, thank you for saying that. That's very nice of you to say. I mean, the one idea I guess I was thinking about with his wife's name was Maxine, was the idea that damaged people attract damaged people. And so Al's kind of, you know, I always feel like Al was always kind of had the wind knocked out of him. in life, just a little bit. And so he, and being, I think, a musician, you know, you hang out with different kinds of people. And so his wife, you know, struggled most of her life with mental health issues. And I, you know, I was really interested in how two damaged people kind of find each other and try the best, you know, they can for who they are to make a go of it. But yeah, that's my, the scenes with her are my favorites in the book.
Late in the book, and I'm not going to give away anything about this, but late in the book, Al is on this epic quest and she saves his life. And this is so beautiful how you do this. I just love this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's that idea of hope, you know, like when, or like what's inside you can get you through memories or dreams of what you want if you don't up can have, you know, both seduced me and kept me going, I think, most of my life. Maybe that's why I was so drawn both to novels and music, is like the gift inside them, which is to experience something else or to see outside your own life, and music as well as novels, the idea of escapism. I think that's what brought me to both of them, I think, was just the ability to put a song on and all of a sudden you're not you anymore. You're, you know, you're in Bruce Springsteen land, or you're in Tom Waits land, or you're living with the Pogues, or you're with Candy State and the great soul singer, and you're so far from yourself, and it just gives you a break. And then novels is like a deep dive into that, and they both kind of saved my life.
We've got that wonderful feeling when we immerse ourselves in a book, and then we have that other incredible experience where we go and we see a band or a performance that we just absolutely dig. And you talk about in some of your press material, or maybe it's in the book, you talk about how your brother took you to see a show. I think it was Rank and File.
Yeah. I mean, I was such a sucker for music because I was a really shy kid and I really struggled going to school and all that. And a friend of my brother's told me, he said, look, you just, if you're nervous or things aren't going your way at home or whatever, just disappear into a song, and it'll protect you. I mean, the kid was 15, and I think I was 11 at that point, and it really meant a lot to me. And I dedicate part of the book to him, that kid. But so I really took that to heart. So I really fell in love with music. And then my brother moved to Los Angeles when I was 13, and that was when, like, the cowpunk scene was going, X and the Blasters and Los Lobos and were all around, and as was a band called Rank and File, and they were, you know, these brothers that sang kind of working-class songs, kind of country songs made by kind of weirdos, like punk rock guys singing kind of angry country songs. And my brother took me, and it definitely wrecked me. You know, I was like, "That's the kind of music I want to play, and I want to be in a small time band like those guys." I never once thought about, you know, I want to be in Led Zeppelin. My aspirations were pretty small. I didn't even think much about having to stand in front of people or any of that. I just loved the idea of creating records that you could disappear into.
Let me guess, these brothers like to play really fast.
Not as fast, yeah. Kind of inspired by that a little bit.
Okay.
That whole scene. But yeah, that in the book, the fun I had in the book was all the different bands he was in, from you know, like a kind of a grifter, cowboy, make-believe guy who sounded like Merle Haggard, to, you know, a weird kind of sister act, to a guy that sings like Johnny Cash, to all these different bands he's in. But then as that casino era ends in the 80s, he's kind of left adrift, and he finds these two brothers, the Sanchez brothers, who are, you know, my dream. They can sing like the Everly Brothers, but they like to play really, really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And he joins that band as an old man. He's in his 40s by that point.
That segment felt like it was really ripped out of real life. My guest is Willie Vallotton, and we need to take another break. Can I pick a song off the new CD by the D-Line to take us into this break?
That's great. I'd love that.
Okay. Tell us about this one. This one I'm picking out is called Nancy.
Oh, yeah, Nancy and the Pensacola Pimp. You know, that was one of those, that, like Amy, the singer, she's like, you really want me to sing this? Because, again, she's so, you know, she's not as dark-minded. But she did tell me, Amy sometimes will give me tips. She'll go like, look, why can't a woman get away with the money? Why does, can't the woman go out with a bad guy and then get away and everything works out good for her? Or can a middle-aged woman do good? So I said, I went home and I started writing those songs. So I wrote Maureen's Gone Missing, which was, a middle-aged woman gets away with the money. And then I wrote Nancy and the Pensacola Pimp, where Nancy gets revenge. She gets revenge on a bad guy and gets all the money and gets away scot-free, and she's still young. So it's inspired kind of by Bobby Gentry, the song Fancy. We were, both Amy and I love Bobby Gentry, and so it has that kind of feel. And also the horns by our trumpet player and keyboard player Corey Gray, I think, are really cool on this. And so him and his buddy did the horn section.
Let's listen now to Nancy from the new CD by the D-Lines, and a song written by Willie Vallotton on the Book Nook.
Nancy and the Pensacola Pimp. She was 16 when she got under the thumb of him. He'd stare at her for hours and never let her leave the room. But she knew when to talk, when to keep it in, and how to sidestep when he was cruel. Nancy, the Pensacola Pimp, was 6'5 and 110. Drank nothing but Orange Crush and ate powdered donuts. He'd stay up for weeks on end, making money hand over fist. He was scared of nothing, but he'd lose track of what he said and what he did. Nancy and the Pensacola Pimp. They'd drive around for days and nights. He never stopped talking. Told her about all the houses he owned and where he kept his money hid. But he never remembered what he said, 'cause he never once stopped talking. They'd get so lost on the highway, she wasn't sure they'd ever get back home again. Nancy. Nancy talked him into getting married when she turned 18. He'd been up for 7 days and nights, was living on a different frequency. She had the license, he went on ranting. Passing state lines days and nights until he asked if his eyes. She said that she was sick. So the pimp went on a ride with Cowboy Jim and the narcoleptic. They slit his throat in Biloxi before signing over the title to his car. The narcoleptic slept in
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I've been joined on the telephone out in Oregon by Willie Vallott. And he's got a new novel out. It's called The Horse. And he and his band, the DeLines, have a new CD out. It's called Mr. Luck and Ms. Doom. And you got some nice blurbs on this book. I see you got one from Renee Denfeld. I've had her on the show a few times. In fact, for all of her books, and she's amazing. She's a real Portland person.
Yeah, she's you know, one of the Northwest favorites, and really cool. You know, and she, I think, started out in a band as well. But yeah, I've been lucky enough to do a few events with her, and I love her novels, and we both kind of hang out, and there's a really cool working class part of Portland called St. John's, and I have a little office there that I work on my books and songs, and I always see her around there.
Oh, the plot thickens. And I see that you got a blurb on here from Joe Hill, who, of course, is Stephen King's son. Do you know him?
He was nice enough to read The Horse, and he liked it. And then he and I have become pen pals after that, which is really, really fun. And I got to read a draft of his earlier, his upcoming book, King Sorrow, which is really amazing.
Mm.
So yeah, man, we're just kind of becoming pen pals. That's the most fun thing about being a novelist is, you know, I painted a novelist's house when I was, I think, 33, and that was the first, like, real novelist I'd ever met. So, you know, I just didn't know any writers at all. And so, you know, getting to publish books, you get to meet all these really cool writers. And most of them are really amazing, really nice people. And most novelists love music, and it's really lucky break for me to get to meet all these writers.
Is that somebody we might have heard of? That novelist?
Oh yeah, you know, like I'm friends with a guy named Jonathan Evison, who's a great Northwest writer, who's encyclopedic knowledge of music. And George Pelicanos, the great crime novelist, who, you know, if you ever have a question about music, you should call him. I mean, he knows everything. I mean, he's all genres. He's just an encyclopedia of knowledge. So
he really is.
It goes on and on, and it's really fun to get to meet all these writers. It's just, it's heaven for me.
I've had George on a number of times, and many years ago, probably 22 years ago, he came out here and he gave me a quick quiz on live radio of soul music that he was listening to in Washington, D.C. 50 years ago, and he totally stumped me. I couldn't answer a single
Oh, you know, I asked him once about dub music. I said, you know, I don't know anything about dub. Can you give me, you know, like a place to start? And he came back with a list of like 10 in order of where I should start, and you know, again, it was all amazing stuff. Yeah, he's a legend.
Yeah, he really is. I see where some reviewer compared you to Kent Harif. I had him on the show one time. What an amazing writer! Are you familiar with his stuff?
Oh yeah, yeah. I think I've read all his stuff. Yeah, I was a big fan. Yeah, that's an honor.
Who are some of the others that you've liked to read over the years? I'm guessing maybe you're into Larry Brown or Harry Cruz.
You know, Larry Brown was huge for me. I took a writing class at a night class in my late 20s, and the teacher was really cool. She was like kind of a wild poet, and named Gail Marie Pallmeyer, and she's still a friend of mine. And she turned me on to Larry Brown and Barry Gifford. Two very different writers, but very similar in a way. Larry Brown changed my life because, in a way, he wrote a lot like Raymond Carver. I mean, kind of the soul. Their souls were somewhat similar, but Carver was so dark for me and hit too many nerves. And Larry Brown had more, I don't know, romance to him or hope or love or something. So yeah, I've read Larry Brown from his first book, Facing the Music, and then I read and at the library that same day I picked up Larry Brown, I picked up Barry Gifford's Wild at Heart. And I don't know if you know Barry's work, but
no.
So he wrote Wild at Heart, which became the David Lynch movie Wild at Heart. He also wrote the screenplay for Lost Highway, another David Lynch film. But he wrote, he's written 20 novels maybe, and poetry and short stories. And he also started Black Lizard Press, which brought back into print some of my other big heroes like Jim Thompson and Charles Williford and David Goodis, those kind of crazy crime novelists of, 50s, 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Within 1 week, I found two heroes. And then, William Kennedy was a big hero of mine. Ironweed was a huge book for me. Lucia Berlin's Manual for Cleaning Women has been a huge book for me as well.
I actually had William Kennedy on the program for, I think, his last book, and what an amazing guy. I mean, I was like you. I read Ironweed and all those other books, and I was just like, man, this guy's incredible. And Charles Williford, if there's one dead writer I would love to bring back, it wouldn't be Jim Thompson. It would be Charles Williford. I would absolutely be delighted to ever do an interview with that guy.
I think you're really right. I think Williford would be really fun to talk to and hang out with, and Thompson might be a little tricky. Just not knowing either of them, I would imagine that's the case. And, as far as William Kennedy, I got so lucky once is the Historical Society of Oregon brought William Kennedy to Portland, and they did it at this really fancy hotel. And they had an open bar and hors d'oeuvres. It was a big, fancy thing. And I just walked around kind of following him. I felt bad because I'd never met a guy that was that big a hero of mine, because Ironweed was such an important book. And he gave a brilliant speech, and I was just too nervous to really meet him, but he signed Billy Phelan's Greatest Game.
Mm.
He signed my copy, and he was super cool to me. And it was for a book-loving man, that meeting him was heaven, because he would, if I could write like anybody, if I could have command of the English language like William Kennedy, I'd be a happy man. I always feel like if Tom Waits wrote novels, he'd write them like William Kennedy, maybe. And I'm just a huge fan, so I'm jealous you got to talk to him.
Those Albany books are pretty amazing.
Legs and Billy Phelan's Greatest Game. Also, the Flaming Corsage is up there with my favorites of his. I think that's a brilliant book.
Well, I'm looking at the clock here, and I know you got to run, but I just want to take us out with one more track off the new album by the DeLines. It's Mr. Luck and Miss Doom is the name of the CD. And before I ask about this song, I just want to ask you one more question. Who is Lorraine?
Oh, Lorraine, it was the idea of the drug laws, being what they are. Lorraine was dealing marijuana in Oregon, and she gets caught, and she goes to prison. And when she gets out of prison, marijuana is suddenly legal, and there's marijuana stores. Like in Portland, there's as many marijuana stores as there are bars now, it seems.
Mm.
But she's still a felon. And so she's struggling. She's working, as a maid in a motel, and she's losing hope, and she can't get a better job. And so it was kind of a song about a woman trying to get by as a felon, really, and just the absurdity of. I remember I live in a pretty small town, and I was standing behind these two old ladies, and one old lady was like, those marijuana gummies, they sure help you sleep. And other ladies, well, I use CBD oil on my knee. It helps my knee. And, 5 years previously, they would have, both those ladies would have said, probably we should just throw those people in prison and lock them away forever. It's the devil weed and all that.
Mm.
And then all of a sudden they're converted. So I tried to write, put all that into a song called Don't Miss Your Bus, Lorraine.
You want to go out with that one then?
Yeah, that's a good one. And I love the singing. All the guys sing on this one, backup singing on it. And I think the horns are beautiful. Our bass player, Freddie Trujillo, has the most beautiful voice. He could have been in a doo-wop band. He could have been a crooner. He's just an amazing singer. So we're kind of all group singing on this one, but you can hear his voice in there.
Well, Willie, it's really been a pleasure having you on the program.
Oh, I appreciate it. I wish you could have talked to Charles Williford. I bet you would have had a blast.
My guest has been Willie Vallotton. His new novel is The Horse, and the new album by his band, The DeLines, is Mr. Luck and Ms. Doom. And we're going to take you out of the book nook today with Don't Miss Your Bus, Lorraine.
Lorraine is back in town, in a basement off the freeway. Lorraine ain't sleeping much these days. Oh, a dozen eights. Lorraine's running for her bus.
Don't be late, Lorraine. Don't be late, Lorraine.
The only job she can get is a maid in the back of her head. Is a bee that a felon ain't supposed to make it. Now there's weed stores on every street, even the old ladies and Christians now believe. Lorraine's running for her bus.
Don't be late, Lorraine. Don't be late, Lorraine.
A felon ain't supposed to make it. A felon ain't supposed to make it. Bus.
Don't be late, Lorraine.
Don't miss your bus, Lorraine.
Don't miss your bus, Lorraine.
Don't miss your bus, Lorraine. Your bus, Lorraine. Don't miss your bus, Lorraine.
And that was new music from the DeLines, Willie Vallotton's band. It was such a treat to talk to him about his books and about his music. And what a wonderful book that is, The Horse. And we have just a few extra moments left in the program this morning. And I just heard the news that the actor Gene Hackman and his wife, the classical pianist Betsy Arakawa, died this week in Santa Fe. And Gene will be remembered for all of his movies. I'm sure the obituaries will talk about film after film, but he was also a very literary man. He was a co-author of some fiction, and while I never interviewed him, I did have some interaction with him once upon a time. It was May of 2004. I was visiting my friend Bill Young, who's a literary escort in Chicago, and he said, we need to go get Gene Hackman at his hotel. And we went down to the Drake, and Gene and Betsy met us in the lobby. We went over to Borders, and Gene very patiently did a signing with a long line of people with stacks of movie stills, obviously eBay speculation going on there, and he very patiently signed all of them, and I watched him. I had a chair right there by the table, and then afterwards, we walked back to the Drake. It was a beautiful evening in Chicago. A lot of people out walking around. We got to the hotel, and he said, why don't you come in for a drink? We were with his editor, his co-author, my friend Bill, and Betsy. We went and sat at a table. Gene Hackman very graciously bought us all drinks. And then they proceeded to talk. And I just sat there like the proverbial fly on the wall and savored their conversation, which was all about books. That's what they were talking about, book after book after book. And I just sat there and enjoyed listening and didn't have anything to say. And Betsy would turn to me now and then and she'd say, how are you doing over there? Would you like a drink? Another drink? She was so kind. And I was just listening, and they started talking about Cormac McCarthy. And about halfway through their conversation about McCarthy, Gene Hackman turns to me, and he looks right at me, and he says, what did you think about his trilogy? And I was so flabbergasted that he was actually speaking to me directly. I'm not a person who's often left wordless, but I could not reply. I just sat there looking at him stunned, like he's talking to me. I couldn't say I liked it. I couldn't say anything. And then he just kind of turns like, I guess this guy doesn't talk. And he continued drinking tequila. And just it was lovely. After a while, the chef in the restaurant brought over a great big plate of chocolate-covered strawberries as a little treat for their celebrities. Celebrity, I guess, would be more like it. Gene Hackman really attracted the attention of passersby. As we'd walked back to the hotel that evening, I was walking behind them, and I noticed people doing double takes as they were coming towards us. The sidewalks were packed with people, and they would walk by, and they'd look, and that is Gene Hackman. And he was just walking proud, walking tall. He was in his early 70s then. He died at the age of 95 this week. And earlier, when I was helping my friend Bill by sitting in the chair at Borders Books and observing the book signing, there was a Chicago police officer who was keeping an eye on things. He was making sure the people on the line behaved themselves and everything was going smoothly. And after it was all over and the crowd had dispersed and we were getting ready to leave the bookstore, the police officer came up to me, and he was a big burly guy dressed in uniform. If you're familiar with Chicago cops, they can be fairly intimidating. And he walked up to me and he said, wow, he goes, it was really nice working with you. And I looked at him like, okay, who do you think I am? He says, well, you're Gene's bodyguard, right? The way you were sitting there in the chair. I said, I just assumed that we were working together and that you were just keeping an eye on the crowd and that you would jump up and take care of anybody that misbehaved. He says, I was kind of counting on you to do that. He says, you're not his bodyguard? I said, no, just an acquaintance. So that's my memory of Gene Hackman and Betsy Arakawa, who died this week in Santa Fe. And I understand their dog died too. I imagine there's more to the story as we're taping this, I'm sure the story will develop. But he was quite an amazing actor. And I understand that she was an incredible classical pianist. So just remembering Gene Hackman as we close out the Book Nook. And tune in tomorrow at 10:30 in the morning when Adrian McKenty will be returning to the program. Adrian has a new Sean Duffy novel out, and this might be the last one. Sean Duffy is a police officer in Northern Ireland during the Troubles with the Royal Ulster Constabulary. He's Catholic. Most of his fellow cops are Protestants. There's a lot of tension there, and he's getting ready to retire in this final book, which might be, in my view, the best book yet in the series. It's the eighth book. And when I interviewed Adrian about it, you'll hear him tomorrow. I said to Adrian, I said, gosh, this might be the best book in the series, according to me. He says, what do you mean? He says, it is the best book. So tune in tomorrow at 10:30 for Adrian McKenty right here on WYSO.